This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Al Capone was public enemy number one in the Prohibition era, and he's still the subject of American fascination. Robert De Niro played him in the 1987 film The Untouchables. Now William Forsythe is Capone in the syndicated Untouchables TV series. My guest, Lawrence Berggreen, has written a new biography of Capone. He says he's never written about someone whose real life differed so sharply from his reputation. Berggreen is also the author of biographies of songwriter Irving Berlin and writer James Agee. He says the Capone myth was created by the yellow journalism of the 20s, Hollywood sensationalism, and anti-Italian prejudice. Berggreen concludes that the lawmen who were after Capone were hypocritical and self-serving. They used Capone as a scapegoat for the failure of Prohibition.
Al Capone was not a super criminal. He was a racketeer. If it hadn't been for Prohibition, which began in 1920, he would have been a minor hoodlum and remained in Brooklyn, and where he was born, and nobody ever would have heard of him. Keep in mind that when Capone began his career, he was first an accountant for a legitimate construction company in Baltimore. And he only left that job, at which he was doing quite well, with the beginning of Prohibition, and when his mentor, Johnny Torrio, who was sort of the godfather of modern crime, invited him to come to Chicago to take advantage of some of the opportunities there. And if Prohibition had ended 5 years earlier, Capone would have been remembered only as a sometime gambler and small-time pimp. So the legends about Capone, the apocryphal stories, wound up supplanting the truth about him. In the case of his older brother, who was supposed to be a lawman and a Prohibition agent, I thought those stories were apocryphal. As my research continued, I discovered they were in fact true, and there was more to them than anybody suspected. So that's what made the research for this book so interesting and paradoxical.
Yeah, Capone's older brother, who went by the name Richard Two-Gun Hart because he didn't want to use his name Capone, was a marshal. He was a Prohibition agent.
That's right. I became fascinated by the Capone family, which consisted of eight boys and a girl, as a whole, because there were so many varied personalities. You had Al, who was in the middle chronologically, and we know about him, but then his oldest brother, who was named Vincenzo, ran away from home, which was Brooklyn, served in the First World War, was a sharpshooter, changed his name to Richard Hart because he admired William S. Hart, the silent movie cowboy, and sort of lost himself in this assumed identity in the Midwest in Nebraska. Was the first Capone to become famous and notorious as a very violent lawman who was enforcing Prohibition. In fact, he killed more people in the line of duty than Capone did as a gangster, as an outlaw. And his older brother, Two-Gun Hart, became so unpopular at one point that he was almost lynched by a mob after he had shot a suspected bootlegger.
Did anyone in the government know that Two-Gun Hart was really Vincenzo Capone?
No. And in fact, he was even a bodyguard for President Calvin Coolidge one summer under his assumed name. And nobody realized it. Imagine if a brother of John Gotti was a bodyguard for the president. Today, that would be an analogous situation.
Well, there's another way in which you would like to revise popular history. You say that a lot of Elliot Ness's image is based on half-truths, that he bungled a lot of things. He was a publicity hound. He was an alcoholic.
That's right. Like many people, my impressions of Ness had been conditioned by years of watching movies and television. I discovered that the real Ness had very little to do with bringing down Capone. He was insignificant in that entire process. In fact, Capone was jailed for income tax evasion and not for bootleg violations. However, Ness made... Al Capone was the greatest thing that ever happened to Elliot Ness, who made... a career on boasting, often erroneously, that he was responsible for getting Capone. And when he wrote with a collaborator his book, The Untouchables, this book included many fictionalized episodes of encounters between the two, encounters that never happened and which glorified Ness's role. That book was published a year or two after Ness died, so he was never able to entirely enjoy the fruits of the posthumous fame that it conferred on him.
How close did Ness get to actually catching Capone?
Well, he never got close at all. They once talked on a train after Capone was about to be dragged away to jail, but they never met face-to-face, and all the bootlegging violations, the indictments that Ness rounded up, were thrown out. They were never used in court. So he really didn't get very close. It was the IRS, the tax man, who really came much closer.
What was Chicago crime like when Al Capone came there in the early 1920s working for his mentor, Johnny Torrio?
Well, Chicago had a reputation as the ultimate boomtown at that time. It had grown unbelievably quickly. It was Carl Sandburg's Chicago. It was brawling and lusty and big-shouldered and all of that. There was a Victorian type of crime. There were some brothels. They weren't particularly organized. There was the rudiment of an organized pimps association. Once Torrio came in, they very quickly carved up the territory, organized it. They combined brothels, gambling, and bootlegging, usually in the same establishment. Typically, the bar, the saloon would be on the ground floor. The gambling would be one floor up, and the brothel would be one floor above that. So that was the trinity of vice that Johnny Torrio, who was a generation older than Capone, put together. Torrio gave Capone control of this empire after he decided he was too old and this was too dangerous a way to live. So by the time Capone was 26 or 27, he took over the fastest growing vice empire in the country.
And how did he change it when he took it over in 1925?
Well, he came in with his family, which made a difference. It wasn't just one person. There was another brother named Frank, and there was another older brother named Ralph, often went by the name of Bottles Capone. And they organized it further. They continued to extend the territory. They were very good entrepreneurs. They also built strong connections to the city's civic establishment, to the politicians. This meant bribes. This meant supplying booze to everybody who wanted it. And this meant becoming very close with the newspapers and the newsrooms. Bribing reporters in those days was very common. So, and they gave news conferences all the time. So there was nothing particularly shadowy or furtive about their activities. By today's standards, they were extremely bold and extremely public.
Were they public about their vice? Public about the vice operations that they ran, the rackets?
They were public about the gambling, and they were public about the bootlegging. In fact, they advertised it. They were not at all public about the vice for obvious reasons, but they were willing to, but everybody knew. And one of the sources of Capone's strength within the rackets was his willingness to function as a pimp. Other racketeers avoided it. They considered it an infamy and wouldn't get anywhere near it. But Capone was up to his arms in it. And that was the worst insult anybody could hurl at Capone, was the word pimp. And I think because it was true.
My guest is Lawrence Berggren, has written a new biography of Al Capone. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about Al Capone with biographer Lawrence Berggren. Now, you said that Capone drew strength from the hypocrisy of the political establishment, particularly the hypocrisy around prohibition. Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
Well, Capone was a gregarious person. He was in many ways a generous person. He gave away a fortune. He gave away many fortunes to the poor and the indigent in Chicago, and especially when the Depression hit and there were very few social services at that time. Capone filled a role as a de facto employment agency and for thousands of Chicago citizens, especially Italians. He gave them jobs as truck drivers, or he gave them money to use or not use their garages. He was also impulsively generous in many ways. In the book, I tell the story of the great jazz bassist Milt Hinton, who, while he was struggling as a teenager in Chicago to get established, worked as a sometime bootlegger delivery boy in Chicago, and was involved in a serious car accident. And he went flying through the windshield of his car, landed on the pavement, and when he came to, he realized that one of his fingers was dangling by a thread. He went to a hospital, and the doctor was going to amputate it. Once Capone got word that one of his bootleggers, even a very minor figure, was having this problem, he got a hold of Hinton's mother, and went with her down to the hospital and ordered the doctor to sew the finger back rather than amputating it. Of course, when Al Capone told you to do something, you did it. So the doctor did that, and as Hinton later told me, the finger was sewn on a little crooked, but it worked just fine. And he went on to become one of the most recorded musicians of all time.
Well, why is it that the government could only get Capone on taxes? Why is he so hard to get any other way if he's running so many rackets?
Well, it was a question of what you could get a jury to convict him on. And there were three choices. The first, the most obvious, was violations of prohibition of the Volstead Act. However, that would be hard to get a jury to do because most jurors applauded for Capone for doing that. The second way would be murder charges. And now at that time, murder charges were almost always state charges, not federal charges. And they also printed the names, addresses, and photographs of jurors in the newspapers. Therefore, if a gangster were being tried for murder, and it often happened in Chicago, the first thing that his cronies did was go after the jurors, and they would either bribe them or intimidate them into acquitting. And that happened all the time. So that wasn't practical. That left the rather new alternative of trying Capone for income tax evasion. It was only in 1927 when the federal court, when the Supreme Court reinterpreted the tax laws and decided that you could do this, that undeclared income, you had to pay income tax on undeclared income, i.e. bootlegging and illegal income, as well as legal income, that the government had the power to do this. Now, that was rather dry and technical and sort of abstract, and that lent itself well to a jury trial because it didn't seem like there was much at stake.
My guest is Lawrence Berggreen. He's written a new biography of Al Capone. We'll continue our conversation in a minute. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about Al Capone with biographer Lawrence Berggreen. It was when Capone was in prison that he was diagnosed with a mental deterioration resulting from syphilis, which he had contracted as a younger man, which he thought that he had healed from after the sores went away. And I want you to talk about this a little bit because you think of this syphilis as being key to understanding Capone's whole character.
Yes, I felt it was. Under the Freedom of Information Act, I obtained extensive medical and psychological records on Capone that were kept after he went to prison in various files. There's a Federal Prison Bureau file, and there's a so-called Notorious Offenders file, the National Archives, and they contain these records. I went over them with a couple of doctors, and one of the things that we discovered was that Capone had probably contracted the syphilis as a very young man, which I took to mean as a teenager, that it had lain dormant for about 20 years, and as often happens, and then came to the surface and more or less exploded by the time he got to Alcatraz. And this manifested itself in a dementia. It was sort of like having Alzheimer's. And Capone went crazy there after a while and stopped functioning and spent a considerable amount of time in the prison hospital. In fact, spent a considerable amount of time in a almost like a huge cage. He lived like a caged animal for over a year there because he was considered so dangerous. Although actually, once the syphilis began working on his brain, he was far less dangerous than he would have been at any other time. In fact, Capone was never really a dangerous prisoner. He was always very compliant and was often picked on by other prisoners.
Well, your theory is that the dementia caused by syphilis actually was part of the reason why he became a violent man as a gangster.
Yes.
That sounds really revisionist to me.
One of the classic symptoms of syphilis is feelings of megalomania, and also wild or increasingly pronounced mood swings. People who know a victim of syphilis well wouldn't see it because the changes tend to be incremental. But over a period of years, the increments really build up. It seemed to me that if Capone had never had syphilis, he would never have had the huge outbursts that he was known for instance, the time when he battered three men nearly to death with a baseball bat just before they were finished off by some assassins.
Is that the story that became the famous scene with De Niro in the recent movie, The Untouchables?
Right, that inspired it. That inspired it. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of outbursts would not have happened if he hadn't been suffering from syphilis.
What makes you say that, though? How can you say that?
Well, otherwise, Capone tended to be, he was not a pathological or criminal kind of personality. He was not inherently violent as a young man, and he did not particularly like to use his fists. He was known as a very good dancer, but the syphilis distorted his personality. There's another thing that I should bring up, too, and that was his cocaine addiction, which was something else I discovered from his medical records, which hadn't been generally known before. But Capone had been a very heavy cocaine user when he was in Chicago. The cocaine was easy enough to come by. It was very prevalent in those days. And especially in brothels where he worked, many of the prostitutes there used cocaine. Capone blew a hole in his septum because he snorted so much of it, and that's how the doctors became aware of that.
You know, reading your book, I almost felt like you wanted to like Capone so much. You were finding all these outside reasons to explain his most violent outbursts.
Well, it wasn't so much Capone personally, because there was much about him that was irredeemable or contemptible, but in the book, I was also trying to explore the entire gangster ethos, and it seemed to me that the stereotype of the murderous Southern Italian criminal, which had been a very popular one at the beginning of this century, and which Capone was a major part of, or the Capone legend was a major part of, really didn't have that much basis in fact, and was in many ways outmoded and a damaging stereotype, sort of like Step and Fetch It or Shylock. And I thought it was worth re-examining that, because unlike those other stereotypes, this one still keeps going on today.
When Capone got out of prison, he was your basic washed-up gangster. I guess a crime had passed him by. He was old hat.
That's right.
What had changed while he was in prison?
Well, the repeal, for one thing. And so that was the end of the Jazz Age, the end of Prohibition, and all the money and power that it brought to gangsters like him. Also, his mind was gone. He functioned at a very low level after that, and lived in kind of a fog. So he could no longer resume his role in the rackets. And his brothers, some of whom tried to take over or take up the standard that he had thrown down, were not really as capable as Al and couldn't do the same thing. Also, many other racketeers learned a lesson from Capone, and that lesson was to avoid publicity. They felt that more than anything else had been his undoing, and they tended to operate much more in the shadows than Capone did. Capone was addicted to publicity and press conferences, and he loved to know anybody who was powerful, whether it was sports figures or politicians. And his successors were much more careful.
What would Capone do at his press conferences?
Well, he would try and justify himself. He was a good debater, and he would point to the hypocrisy of his accusers, which was true. He would gloss over his own crimes. And, of course, he served booze to the reporters, which immediately got them on his side.
How could he do that? How could he serve booze to them?
Well, he had it there. It was his own booze that he brewed in his own breweries. And
But that makes the reporters complicit.
Well, they were. And I interviewed a number of reporters from that era, and they were happy to drink his booze, to go to his parties, to accept his cigars, tickets to fights that he controlled, almost anything that they attended, parties that he gave at his house in Miami Beach. Almost any kind of largesse that he dispensed, they were happy to receive.
I wonder if writing this book you thought a lot about America's almost love-hate relationship with gangsters. I mean, you know, gangsters kill, gangsters violate the law, and Americans hate them for that, and yet gangsters become heroes or anti-heroes. Think of how many movies and books have been written about them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we need our bad guys. I think it's we need the psychological or imaginative release that they provide. As Mark Twain once said, heaven for climate, hell for company. They're so much more interesting than average people.
I want to thank you a lot for talking about your biography of Al Capone.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Lawrence Berggren is the author of Capone, The Man and the Era.